dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the War of Ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world, a man who I have come to know and admire greatly for his acumen about, well, just about everything. He is truly a Renaissance man, but particularly his grasp of the great sweep of history and the importance of culture, and most especially our civilization to that trajectory, if it is in fact to be one that is conducive to freedom and the great enabling of freedom in this country that we've had the privilege to inherit from our forefathers, quite a number of whom fought and bled and died for us to have that privilege. His name is Michael Walsh. He is the author of 6 highly acclaimed novels, a hit television movie. He's been a journalist. He's a screenwriter. And he is, well, just an amazing intellect and talent, as they say. And he's a good friend. And I'm very proud to have him here for a full hour to talk about a number of things, but we're going to talk particularly about what's at stake in the culture wars and how we are faring in them. Michael Walsh, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. It is so good to have you with us, and thank you for giving so generously of your time.
Hey, Frank. Thanks. It's great to be on with you and to be able to share our thoughts on the current crisis with all the listeners.
Well, the current crisis is about the sum of it, isn't it? But before we get to the current crisis, I want to do a compare and contrast with you, if I could, Michael. We often rail against the culture and how bad things are at the moment, but not so long ago, arguably in a moment that was a pinnacle for America, the D-Day invasion, whose anniversary, the 75th anniversary, to be precise, we commemorate and celebrate today, is in sharp contrast, I think it's fair to say, in a number of respects, to the current mindset, the attitude towards our country, the sort of love and willingness to sacrifice for it that was in such pronounced evidence those 75 years ago and throughout World War II, and indeed through much of our history. Let's talk a little bit about it. I know you're writing a new book. It will be, I guess, your 8th, following on to Fiery Angel, Art, Culture, Sex, Politics, and the Struggle for the Soul of the West. It's a book about military history, and I know you've given a lot of thought to history and specifically this moment in it, but give us sort of an appreciation, if you would, of what all made that moment in World War II so profoundly important, even today?
No, that's a good question, Frank. I should just say, just not my 8th, but it'll be my 16th or 17th, because in addition to the novels, I've done a whole bunch of nonfiction books, including, as you just so kindly mentioned, The Fiery Angel, which itself was a sequel to a book that was a breakout bestseller 2 years ago called The Devil's Pleasure Palace. And in both of those books, I analyzed the current cultural, historical, and political situation. So let me just preface this by saying something that's not original with me. It's by one of my Twitter followers, and I have some very, very good, thousands of very good ones. And someone said, you know, the late Andrew Breitbart, who, Frank, as you know, I worked very closely with and was the founding editor of BigJournalism.com when we were putting all the Breitbart sites together back in 2010. Andrew was wrong in one sense when he said that politics is downstream from culture. Actually, politics is culture, and culture is politics. One is not a reaction to another one. And so I guess it depends on how we define culture, but as you've so kindly said in the introduction, I try to look at culture as a unity, as a big sweep from the Greeks to the present, and then put what's happening in our present context into that overall context. So the answer is what happened at D-Day 75 years ago, and also another major anniversary coming up this year, one that I was fortunate enough to be at, which is the fall of the Berlin Wall in November of 1989. Those are two very different worlds, almost, from the one we live in the present. And as you mentioned, I am writing a new book for St. Martin's Press about certain battles throughout history, starting with the Greeks and to the present. And my subject is what makes men, and I mean men, not women, want to fight and die for something larger than themselves. What is it in the soldierly temperament, as we have understood it until relatively recently in the American armed forces, that makes people give up their lives for something greater? Because that presumes that there is something greater for which to die. And as we know, soldiers from the time of the Spartans and the Romans certainly felt that death in battle was the most glorious way to go you could go. And they created empires, literally, that existed on that principle until it was worn away by inanition, sloth, laziness. One of the things that killed the Roman Empire was a drastically declining birth rate, so that they had to import soldiers and make barbarians into citizens because their own population was not progressing, the way it did. And one of the things that caused Rome to be dominant was that they replaced those soldiers rapidly because the women were very fecund and fertility was a very important thing. They had fertility gods. So that's a long way of saying things have changed now. And I believe, from my perspective, I went to college in 1967. So my college years were 67 to 71, which was the belly of the leftist campus revolt beast. If you recall those years, it's basically from the Christmas bombing of Hanoi through Kent State inclusive, and not to mention the Summer of Love and everything else. So the culture changed. And what happened was people said, there's nothing worth giving up your life for, that the sense of personness is so important that it's not worth sacrificing yourself, even for your wife, your children, much less your tribe, your neighborhood, your country, or your culture. So what the left did over those years from the 60s to the present is to not only inculcate that in people's minds, but to, with the elimination of the teaching of history, qua history, and not as some kind of political grievance statement, we no longer have the history that we used to have to fall back on. So, as I mentioned in several books, when you have nothing to defend, you're literally defenseless. And that's where we are today.
We'll be right back with more with Michael Walsh, the author of, among 17 books, The Fiery Angel, Art, Culture, Sex, Politics, and the Struggle for the Soul of the West. Straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back. We are visiting for this full hour, I'm thrilled to say, with Michael Walsh, who has both covered the tremendous changes and transformative events of our time as a correspondent for Time magazine, for example, as a best-selling author, as a screenwriter, driving force behind multimedia productions. He is an extraordinary resource, and I'm very pleased to have him with us. We're talking a bit about his latest book, The Fiery Angel, and one that is now in the works, a military history of some of the world's great battles. And Michael, we were just talking a little bit about, the concern that I must say I have increasingly that we may not be up to any longer. The willingness to sacrifice and fight and, if necessary, die for our country, as previous generations have done, enabling, as President Reagan used to say, the existential threats to freedom to be vanquished in generation after generation after generation. The question, I guess, occurs, are we, in fact, going to be up to it in our own time? Because we certainly are confronting existential threats to it now. Your thoughts?
Yeah, well, my thoughts is there's so many things wrapped up in that one question, Frank, and indicates the complexity of this issue. One is that our military is essentially volunteer, that is essentially mercenary army, as the ancients would have called them. The elimination of what's now referred to as toxic masculinity has devalued the warrior ethos to a tremendous extent. When the Carthaginians and Romans fought the Punic Wars, the Carthaginians lost and would have lost much sooner if Hannibal hadn't been such an absolute tactical but not strategic genius that he was able to annihilate the Roman army almost in toto at the Battle of Cannae. But the Carthaginians were a mercenary army, and the Romans weren't. And one of the things that surprised the Carthaginians is even though the Romans lost up to 75,000 men slaughtered on the field in one day, they replaced that army very, very quickly. They levied conscripts. Their women were having children. There were always people in the pipeline. None of that is true today. So Americans need to think. History doesn't repeat itself, but it sometimes rhymes, as the saying goes. And if we are, in fact, in the late Roman Empire part of the American history, then I think we've got some problems that we need to address, but because of political correctness, cannot. And that's, we must destroy political correctness in order for us to survive.
Well, that's where I wanted to go next with you, Michael Walsh. We're looking at the sort of cumulative effects of what has been called the march through the institutions of cultural Marxists who sought to have precisely this end state where we've lost our moorings. We no longer have an appreciation of the amazing character and qualities and freedoms that this country provides us. Talk a little bit about our educational system as an example of how this takeover has been accomplished over the past few generations. You started talking a little bit about your own experiences in college, but you know, give us a sense of how that's manifesting itself, this cultural Marxist agenda in the educational system today.
Sure. Well, first of all, the title itself, or the term we use for it, Long March Through the Institutions, comes from Mao. It's a reference to Mao's famous Long March during the Chinese Civil War, the communist takeover, with his battle with Chiang Kai-shek. So the leftist applied that same reasoning that we're in this for the long haul, and we are going to make this long march, and within a generation or two, we're going to have won the war and transformed the society. So people who hear that phrase need to know it is, in fact, the very essence of cultural Marxism. As I say in The Devil's Pleasure Palace, the prequel to Fire Angel, the Marxists realized, especially after the First World War, which was a destruction of European culture that we frankly probably will never recover from, but they realized that economic Marxism had failed. When the revolution happened in Russia and not in Germany, they were stunned because their scientific models had not predicted this. So between the wars, this is when the Frankfurt School began to develop the school of Marxist philosophers. So it's exemplified by Lukács in Hungary and Antonio Gramsci in Italy. Between the wars, they worked assiduously to create a cultural version of Marxism that was not economically dependent. And once World War I was finished by its own sequel, World War II, then the Marxist philosophers had come here fleeing Hitler and started off in our university. So, for example, when I was in college, Herbert Marcuse was a very, very prominent living philosopher, and we read Marcuse's works. And so this poison kind of entered the body politics bloodstream through the baby boomer generation. And as the baby boomers finally start shuffling off the stage, we're seeing the end game and the result of that corruption of what should have been a great generation of Americans, but wasn't.
Yeah. It didn't confine itself, though, this march to education. You've spent much of your life in and around Hollywood and the media more generally. Talk a little bit about, well, the phenomenon, I guess, of fake news and the hard left's agenda being force-fed through these various platforms, movies, plays, you know, television programs, YouTube videos, and on.
Right. Well, the left understood that propaganda is a very important tool. They not only raised this generation of teachers, college professors, many of whom are now retiring or dying off, but they have seeded the universities with more of these dragon's teeth so that every time one dies off, 10 more spring up. But they also went into the media. The media was very important to the Frankfurt School of Philosophers. So Theodor Adorno, who was a music critic and a composer, someone I encountered in the realm of music when I was a student at the Eastman School of Music, later realizing his philosophical bent as well, he was quite critical of American media, and at the same time, they wanted to seize the high ground there. I think it's important to realize that or understand that for the left, everything is a tool to advance the political objective. Sometimes conservatives think, for example, those of us who witnessed the Reagan landslide in 1984, or even the Nixon landslide in 72, felt that, okay, well, we've beat them now. Now we can go home, beat our swords into plowshares, and go back to our lives. But it's really crucial to understand this is their lives. They have nothing better to do than to stay up night thinking about how they can affect and further the cause of the revolution. They are really dedicated revolutionaries, and I must say I have to give them credit for that, because as I like to say on Twitter, they never stop, they never sleep, they never quit. They are always at you. So we have to realize that this is what is happening and find some method of combating it before it's too late.
Well, we're going to come back to this question of what do we do about it, but just to further drill down on the phenomenon and the challenge that it poses to us in the culture war, talk a little bit about the inexorable leeching of what's gone on in academia and what has been the principal product of Hollywood in the way of this propaganda and the other media on our political lives and system, Michael Walsh. This is where the rubber meets the road, as they say, but talk a little bit about how the revolution is progressing in that space.
Sure. Well, college now is not like it was when you and I were in college, obviously. We went there to study something. I went there to study music very specifically. I didn't go there for a political reason. To its credit, the Eastman School of Music, which is one of America's foremost conservatories, had nothing whatsoever to do with politics. We were in the practice room. We were composing. We were organizing ensembles. We were playing chamber music. That's all we did. We did, however, talk a lot about what was going on in the world. That is, the Vietnam War, the student revolt, the student strikes. That all affected us, and we talked about that in the student forums, you know, informally. So we were quite politically aware, but we were not channeled into one mode of political thought or another. The fact that colleges now don't teach, but they are effectively a giant bureaucracy of political correctness with such shibboleths as, you know, diversity and tolerance and all this boilerplate that the Marxists use to disguise their true intentions, that it's a wonder if students learn anything. All the diversity studies, as somebody said, any course that says something studies is not a real course. And that's the truth. In Hollywood, slightly different. And I've defended Hollywood. I've been there a long time. I've never had a political discussion in a story meeting. I've worked with some of the most liberal producers in Hollywood. Never once has politics come up, mine or theirs or anybody else's. However, that may not necessarily be true of the younger ones, who seem to be very much infected by this sort of Marxist a virtue signaling speak in which everything now must be channeled through various prisms of race, sex, class, etc. And when you start doing that, the taxonomy of an industry, you've been taken over by Marxists, because that's what Marxism is. It's dividing people up according to race, sex, class, gender.
For the purpose of dividing them and dominating them completely. Michael, we have to pause for one more moment. We'll be right back with a further conversation on some of the characters that have now emerged prominently in American political life, imbued with this hostility towards America and its advocacy of the other side in the culture war. Right after this.
More with Frank Gaffney.
We're back. We are continuing this hour-long conversation with an extraordinary, well, Renaissance man, is the way I think of him. In addition, as he's mentioned, to his accomplishments in writing books, in making movies, in creative arts of various kinds, he is also a musician and a scholar of music and the author of several important books, Who's Afraid of Classical Music? Who's Afraid of Opera? And a book about Carnegie Hall, the first 100 years, among others. Michael Walsh, we're talking about the culture war. We're talking about the degree to which the hard left, the revolutionary left, has marched through the various institutions of this country, and I think of them as kind of termites, hollowing it out, setting it up for destruction. We were just discussing how this is manifesting itself now in political affairs, and specifically in the Democratic Party as kind of the leitmotif of its legislative agenda, its rhetoric, its program more generally. You've recently written at AmericanGreatness.com about three of the most prominent young stars of the current Democratic Party. I'd like you to talk a bit about each of them in turn, and specifically in this context, what do we know about whence they came and what their agenda is and what it might mean for the country if they are in fact going to be the face and dominant forces in the Democratic Party going forward?
Well, we're talking about, of course, AOC, as she's now referred to in pop cultural parlance, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, and Ilhan Omar, Congresswoman from Minnesota, and Rashida Tlaib, Congresswoman from the Detroit area. AOC represents a district in the Bronx and Queens in New York City. I was thinking as a prep to talking about them, back to the notion of how the Romans fought, and it's a good example of what we're going through right now, and that is that the left comes at us from every conceivable angle, and all three of these women are doing that as well. But when the Romans were successful, they stayed in their phalanx formations, and each man protected the man next to him. So that formation generally was highly successful against undisciplined barbarians who would run up, throw rocks, and run away. And if you read Caesar's commentaries, you see how time and again he was able to outmaneuver the very gallant Germans and the Celtic Gauls, but to defeat them at all times. If we stay together and hold on to our culture, we can beat these people. But if we give up and panic, as the Romans did at Cannae, then we get destroyed. So with these three, they're all atypical congresspeople up to now in the history of the United States, not only being women, but being, as the Marxists would like to say, women of color, minorities.
Woke.
Yeah, woke. Yes, they're very woke. Marxist categorizations. Cortez is the most dangerous because she's the most media savvy. She was clearly targeted for this gig. She raised something like $20 million for a congressional seat that no one had ever thought about before, which was held by an old Irish machine politician as a kind of sinecure. It was a district that's heavily Democrat and probably always will be. But somebody, as they say in The Silence of the Lambs, talking about the beetle that they find inside the cadaver's mouth, somebody loved this little guy. Somebody fed him. Somebody watered him. Somebody nurtured him, talking about this very rare moth. Well, she's a very rare moth, and somebody, the Democrat Party, clearly put their money behind her and got her elected. And the way you know this, Frank, is because I have very many friends, you know, who've been in journalism as long as I have, so they're all quite well-known people now. The second she won that primary, she was all over Twitter, and I had never heard of her. And suddenly the media made her a star, and this is where I'm going. All of these three representatives are media creations. Without the media, they're just obscure Congress people from backwater districts.
There's information on the web, and one never knows whether to credit it or not, but to the effect that, as you say, AOC was in fact the product of kind of a beauty pageant to find somebody who would have the requisite physical attributes to become the vessel for a lot of revolutionary, you know, sort of ideological fervor, and was essentially groomed, trained, and produced for this purpose. I don't know if, again, that's true, but it sounds right to me.
No, it's absolutely true, because as we've just been talking, the Democrats dominate the media and Hollywood and the educational institutions. They know show business sells, and they use it. Our side is absolutely hopeless in dealing with this. They don't understand it. They don't put any money behind it, and this is one of my principal complaints about Republican donors. They want to say, what's my return on my investment? Nobody asked, oh, okay, here's $20 million for AOC. They didn't ask. They know what the return on their investment is. She will be in that seat forever. That's what they know.
Or something higher.
Yeah, or something higher as soon as she gets old enough to run for Senate or president, God forbid. The same is true with Ilhan Omar. She checks the box. She's Muslim. She's black. She's a refugee. So they can play on, again, all the American sympathies for minorities, which is one of our most admirable qualities as Americans, as the country has shown throughout its history. She is, I believe, a dedicated enemy of the United States. I think she's raised in a community that despises Western Judeo-Christian civilization. Well, we know it does. We just have to read its sacred writings. And she is a destabilizing force, and Nancy Pelosi was kind enough to put her on the Foreign Affairs Committee, where she has available to her classified documents. So that's not good. And then the third one, Rashida Tlaib, is a Palestinian, and we know pretty much how the Palestinians feel about the Jews, for example, and she is now the representative of that sizable Arab-Muslim community. There were always Arabs in the Detroit area, but they tended to be Lebanese Christians. If you may remember the old Uncle Tanous character back in television's golden era, was Danny Thomas was a Lebanese Arab, but he was Christian. That's changed now.
And it's not just that they're Muslim, it's that they are Sharia supremacist Muslims. And yes, you see that in both of these women, I think, very clearly. And when you describe them as hostile to the United States, you know, there will be some who will bridle at that, but you don't have to look beyond what they're saying, what they're campaigning for, what they're trying to get legislated, to realize that they are every bit as much committed to, as Obama used to say, the fundamental transformation of the United States as any of these radical leftists. In fact, I think it's the perfect example of the red-green axis, where you see the AOCs of the red, the revolutionary left, and the green Islamist types making common cause, despite their obvious differences in terms of the end state. But when you look at this, Michael Walsh, as you know, sort of where the opposition party, I guess you would call it, even though it's now running the House of Representatives, the opposition certainly to President Trump and the Republican Senate, where they are. I mean, I'm a former product of a Democratic Senate office under the late Senator Henry Scoop Jackson. So I'm often, you know, bemused by the RPM at which he is spinning in his grave as he sees what these radical leftists are doing in his party. He would have had no truck with it were he alive, of course. But What does it mean for the culture war? What does it mean for the future of the country if a party that has, you know, clearly an appeal to young people, large numbers of young people, and is intent on bringing in large numbers of illegal aliens and is intent on otherwise, you know, giving the vote to felons and the like, is in, I think, a position in the not too distant future to have, if not a permanent lock on American politics, certainly one approaching that.
Well, I think this, Frank, and I think this ray of hope here is that the left always overreaches and it always assumes that everyone agrees with it. So it is driven by a kind of satanic, and I use that word completely advisedly, desire to push boundaries. You'll notice in media coverage, HBO pushes boundaries in new series about teen sex, whatever, right? So they can't stop. Once they start, the only way that they can go is all the way to the negation of what they were originally trying to accomplish. And I think, if we phalanx-like hold firm against this, we can beat them. This is why they have been driven out of their minds by the Trump election of 2016. They didn't see it coming. It violated every sense of their arc of history, which is another Marxist term, by the way, and their adherence, as James Comey likes to say, to a higher loyalty, a higher authority, a higher power, that it really broke them. And I think we need to, and if we had an effective counter-propaganda campaign, we could do this quite easily. And that's why, frankly, I wrote both The Devil's Pleasure Palace and Fiery Angel. If we counteract them, we can win. But they have cut our young people off from their history, and they don't know. And they think socialism is being nice to the kid next to you in kindergarten. That's what they think socialism is. I was in Russia when Chernobyl blew up. You want to see socialism in action, buddy? That was it. I was in Moscow just before the coup against Gorbachev. I was in East Berlin many, many times as the dying beast died. I will never get the smell out of my nose, Frank. It stinks to high heaven. What it does to people is it turns them into zombies who are forced to be lying hypocrites just to survive. And if our young people don't understand this, they're in for a very, very nasty surprise.
Yeah. Well, the bigger concern is our country is in for a very nasty future. And this is really what I want to get to in our final segment with you, Michael Walsh, is you talk about the phalanx hanging together, you know, fighting the good fight. Let's get down to specifics about what we must do. Those of us who love America, those of us who appreciate the extraordinary importance of the freedom it provides its people and what it has done to nurture it elsewhere around the world to ensure it survives for another generation. That and much more straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back for the final and very, I think, important segment of this conversation with Michael Walsh. We're talking throughout about our culture and civilization and prospects. And Michael, I wanted you to conclude by describing some of the thinking and writing and speaking that you've been doing of late to prescribe what those of us who stand against this assault on freedom and our culture and our civilization, what we can do to stave off what is seemingly otherwise the inevitable decline and fall of the American Republic?
Well, that's a good question, Frank. I mean, I must say you've just quoted the former President Barack Obama when he, in his famous speech upon his ascendancy, said before the election, we're 5 days away from the fundamental transformation in the United States. And I turned to everybody I knew at that point, being a 60s kid, and I said, I know exactly what he means. And he meant it. And luckily, he was too lazy and just too weak to actually get through a lot of the programs I think they wanted him to get through. But we have to go back to the past. As I say in The Fiery Angel, sometimes the way forward is backwards. So I don't mean that we have to go back and rigidly adopt practices and ethos of the past. As I mentioned about the Greek phalanx turning into the Roman legions, the Romans developed it. made it more mobile, developed, turned it into maniples and columns. The Europeans learned from the classical civilization that was preserved throughout the Carolingian period in the 8th and 9th centuries up through the Enlightenment. We always take our past and we change it. So we're not against change. We're not those old guys yelling, get off my lawn. But what we need to do is reconnect to the wellsprings of our culture. Because let's face it, Islam is very different from Christianity. You can read any book from the rise of Islam on, and you will see there is a stark black and white division between those things. As it happens, I just finished rereading the famous French national epic, The Song of Roland, La Chanson de Roland, and in both the old French text and an English translation. And that is about the conflict between Islam and Christianity. And very frankly, and unabashedly so, that doesn't mean we need to go out and attack Islam, but it does mean that we cannot adopt Islamic principles into Western formerly Christendom societies because they won't work for us. We will change. They will not. So this is very important. Again, people don't like conflict. They don't like being mean or intolerant, but it isn't about either meanness or intolerance. It's about self-preservation. So a few weeks ago, I gave a speech in Los Angeles in which I announced that some partners and I are now on a crusade, another word I use completely advisedly, to restore Western civilization, starting with our universities, where we have access to some major, major universities in the United States. Where we put these books back on the reading list. As I said in Fiery Angel, there's more political wisdom in Homer than there is in the John F. Kennedy School of Government at Harvard. These texts tell us through the history of writing, thinking, philosophy, art, buildings, music, operas, dramas, what human beings were going through, which is the same thing we're going through, civilizational change, fear of invasion, loss of autonomy, and how they dealt with it. And we need to know that because that's the way forward. As long as we can be raided by these parties like AOC and Omar and Tlaib, as long as we can be attacked by the media every time we turn around and call names and we run in fear, as long as we don't get together, put our shields together, and defend ourselves, we are going to lose. The good news is they always overreach. If you defeat them, they run. You know, dealing with the left, that any honest debate ends after about 3 minutes and they call you a Nazi and they storm off. So they cannot compete in the arena of ideas, but they can compete in the arena of emotions, and that's where we need to do it. And what does it? Art does it. Art makes you proud, to be part of this civilization.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's a very noble goal, and I commend you for taking it on and for pulling in others behind you to do the same, and I hope it will be something that we'll be returning to frequently with you, Michael Walsh. I did want to ask you about one particular piece of this conflict, though, that I'm not quite sure some of the analogies of the past or certainly some of the great battles may really provide us much guidance with, and that is, what happens if you have within your square of Praetorian, you know, legionnaires, an enemy within? What is the implication for the culture war, for our society, for our civilization, that we have, in fact, now operating inside this country, those who are determined to take it down? It's not just external threats. And I just to come to your specific point about Islam, I think we've talked about, I very much have the view that Sharia, which is certainly deeply inside the genetic code of Islam, though it seems quite a number of Muslims don't want to live under this oppressive totalitarian code any more than we do, and don't want to impose it on anybody else. There certainly are large numbers of Muslims who believe that's the true faith and who are all about it. And some of them are in this country, and they're seeking to impose Sharia on their co-religionists here, whether they want to be under it or not, and they're certainly seeking to impose it on the rest of us, which is, again, to your point about Ilhan Omar, again, and Rashida Tlaib as well, I guess, so worrying. But they're simply most public manifestations of this phenomenon. And how do you counsel us to approach that particular phenomenon of the danger inside the wire, if you will, in addition to the one that's obviously exterior to and trying to get here.
Yes, well, as Justice Jackson famously said, the Constitution is not a suicide pact. So we cannot let, well, a good example of this is if you ask young people about that poem on the Statue of Liberty by Emma Lazarus, they'll tell you that's the Constitution of the United States. We cannot let emotions substitute for the plain language of the Constitution. And the Constitution does not say that the American Republic can be hollowed out from within and transformed into something not only different, but exactly antithetical to what the founders wanted. We cannot let the founders be smeared as racists. We cannot let political correctness and these bogus goals of diversity and tolerance and all this stuff substitute for a solid framework of laws that has lasted for 200 plus years that treats everybody fairly. Again, the Marxists will say, yeah, but everybody wasn't being treated fairly. What about this? What about what? They will nitpick us to death, Frank. But we need to expose them for what they are. The media is entirely on their side. So one of the things that my prescriptions, if you wanted them, would be to go to the big Republican donors and say, stop giving money to the parties and start giving it to people who want to restore Western civilization. The parties, the politicians generally aren't interested in doing that, as you and I both well know.
But why is that, Michael? I mean, that is something that I think most people, probably even those listening to this program, who I think are highly attuned to the challenges of our time, would find hard to believe. I mean, Republicans are supposed to be, you know, the pro-America party. They're supposed to be standing athwart what these revolutionaries are trying to do. And yet, as you say, they have been, to a considerable degree, certainly the establishment types in the Republican Party apparatus and elective offices, a grave disappointment to us. But why is that?
Well, I don't know. Ask Paul Ryan, Frank, because he turned the House over to the Democrats, and it's a job well done. How was it possible that we lost every single seat in Orange County, California? How is it possible that some of the congressmen there, no names, please, oh, Daryl Issa, yeah, retired rather than stand up and defend what they ostensibly believe in? How is it possible that such cowardice isn't called out by the Republicans? And they act like it was some kind of act of God that the Democrats used the ballot harvesting loophole to completely wipe out the GOP in California. And if you think they don't want to do that to the rest of the country, you're not paying attention.
Yeah, we have to be paying attention. And this is why your collected works, Michael Walsh, are so important. And I really commend to all of our listeners, not just Fiery Angel, but the body of work that you have provided us. And I know you will be in short order on this new military history about great battles and the lessons to be learned from them. We are arguably in the greatest battle of our time. And that is one that we fail still largely to comprehend, let alone really have, it seems, the wherewithal, the commitment to the country, the love of what it represents to defend it to the bitter end if necessary. I hope we will find in your good counsel, Michael Walsh, that feeling and that we will act on it in time. Come back to us again soon. I hope the rest of you will come back to us again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.